I remember within 10 minutes of seeing the graphical user interface stuff just knowing that every computer would work this way someday. It was so obvious once you saw it. It didn't require tremendous intellect. It was so clear. It was one of those sort of apocalyptic moments. Adele Goldberg. Steve just sat there. Didn't say a word. He sat there staring, and then they left. Trip Hawkins. Steve had his private visit. So then he comes back to Apple, and he goes, "Okay, we've all got to go back and see this again." Steve Wozniak. "There were about 5 of us." Dan Kaki. "It was the members of the Lisa team. The Mac at that point in time was a tiny little thing, just a processor, some RAM, and a video generator. It didn't even have a mouse." Trip Hawkins. "So we were the brain trust that had to go back and see what Steve was all excited about and decide what we were going to do about it." Adele Goldberg. "They came back with the entire development team, Steve Jobs and the entire Lisa programming team. This is what people don't understand." Larry Tesler. "We arranged a bigger demo where we'd show them more." Adele Goldberg. "I said, you're blooming crazy. You can't give a demo to the programming team. That's a how, not a what presentation. That's a complete giveaway." Bob Flegel. "Adele did not want to do that demo. In fact, she turned on her Adele meter pretty high, like only she can do. She really caused quite a stir with management." Adele Goldberg. "I simply said, you order me to do it and I'll go do it. But it's a mistake." They didn't want to know why it was a mistake. Larry Tesler. "Nobody wanted to show them everything. We didn't even want to show them everything that was being done in Smalltalk or everything that was being done on the Alto, let alone show them other hardware and other systems." Adele Goldberg. "Xerox inadvertently did a public disclosure at a level that freed the entire team, my entire research team, from its non-disclosure. That's the story that no one wants to talk about. A legal public disclosure is what happened." Larry Tesler. "We wanted to show them enough that they would build bitmap displays and mice and laser printers and other things
that we could get at a consumerish kind of price,
because they were buying it for a bigger market than we were. And that required showing them a little bit more. So we did." Bruce Horn. "Atkinson was just looking at it so closely, trying to figure it out." Andy Hertzfeld. "Bill Atkinson was the main graphics engineer at Apple, and he was doing the graphics on the Lisa." Bruce Horn. "He was nose to the screen, just trying to figure it out." Trip Hawkins. "We were not complete strangers to bitmapped graphics, because Apple II had them. It's just what you could do with them on an Apple II was kind of limited." Trip Hawkins. "What Park had was completely innovative thinking about the entire user experience." Steve Wozniak. "Multiple windows on the same computer screen? When I saw that, I said, God, it's like you've got 3 computers in one. Once you have that, you'll never go back." The Smalltalk language allowed them to write software in a different way than ever before. Adele Goldberg. "So we proceeded to have a Smalltalk language and implementation discussion, practically giving the answers to the team." Larry Tesler. "I was getting better questions from the Apple management than I ever got from the Xerox management. It was clear that they actually understood computers." Adele Goldberg. "We walked through all the details. All the details." Trip Hawkins. "So that was the seeds of it. Of course, when we came back and were thinking, yeah, so what do we do about this? And by that time, we already had a project." John Couch. "The Lisa." Trip Hawkins. "A dinky little R&D project, and Steve and a handful of engineers had got started on that. And we had a lot of debates about which processor to use. And there had been this debate where a lot of the engineers were thinking, we don't want a mouse." Steve Jobs. "The problem was that We had hired a bunch of people from Hewlett-Packard, and they didn't get it. Trip Hawkins. And this became a real bone of contention. Steve Jobs. I remember people screaming at me that it would take us 5 years to engineer a mouse, and it would cost $300 to build. And I finally got fed up. I just went outside and found Hovey Kelly Design and asked him to design me a mouse. Dean Hovey. I had no idea what a mouse was. Jim Sachs. Steve Jobs said it's going to be the primary interface of the computer of the future. That's how he described it, which we thought was laughable. You could balance a checkbook without a mouse, and you could write basic programs without a mouse. And that was about all people were buying Apple IIs for, that and playing games. And there were already game paddles and joysticks or keyboard input, and nobody could think of what a mouse would be used for in a game. We, of course, went back to the office and snickered and thought, maybe he hasn't had enough meat in his diet.
But if he was willing to pay us $25 an hour to do this,
we would design a solar-powered toaster for him. So we said, sure, Steve. Jim Yurchenko. So the first thing we did was go out and see what ideas we could steal, which is how engineers work. Why reinvent the wheel? And one of the things we came up with was a trackball module, a very large trackball used in Atari game machines. Nolan Bushnell. We did a trackball for the coin-op business. We used it in several games, Missile Command, Centipede, Atari Football. That was a good one. But we really had problems with having it jam and all that. And so we solved a whole bunch of technical problems. Jim Yurchenko. We looked at it, and what they were doing was interrupting beams of light with slotted wheels, a different orientation, and everything was at a much larger scale, and of course the ball was supported by the structure and was depending just on gravity. But it sure seemed like a real promising approach. Jim Sachs. The mouse Xerox had a mean time between failure of something like 1 week, at which time it would jam up irreparably, or the little wire fingers would break. It had a very flimsy cord whose wires would break. Dean Hovey. It just shows, particularly in Silicon Valley, how you take a good idea and run with it and improve it. It's very rare that a lightning bolt strikes and you come up with something that's never been thought of before. It's a lot more taking from this, taking from that, and trying to make something work and going for it. Steve Jobs. In 90 days, we had a mouse that could be built for $15 that was phenomenally reliable. Jim Sachs. People often ask me when they see the mouse patent on my wall whether I invented the mouse. I point out that I did not invent the mouse. Doug Engelbart invented the mouse. His mouse was crude but effective, and remarkable because he demonstrated it, along with a graphical user interface and all kinds of other things at Brooks Hall in 1968. Engelbart's mouse consisted of two rotating discs attached to potentiometers and a big, clunky wooden box. Dean Hovey. Xerox had obviously implemented various versions of it, but the execution around it was still flawed. It wasn't something that would scale such that it could change the world as it had the potential to. Jim Sachs. I credit Steve Jobs with having the vision that that is the way the masses would use computers. One would never have concluded that that would be the primary interface to millions of computers in the future. But he was correct. I think he's not been recognized enough for that. I think people tend to spend more time thinking about the young, brash, rude, obnoxious Steve Jobs of the 1980s. Not that he truly had a vision for seeing this gem in a lab in Xerox Park, and saying they may not be able to commercialize it, but we can. Dean Hovey. We had working prototypes in the late 1980, early 1981 time frame. Jim Sachs. It's also interesting to note that in 1980 at Hovey Kelly, we didn't have access to a computer to plug a mouse into. So we were a little puzzled as to what this thing really was going to do. Trip Hawkins. We gave it to Bill Atkinson, and he wrote a driver that did stuff graphically. And until that happened, there had been this debate where the mouse was a real bone of contention. But when Bill wrote that driver and it did something, and at least half the engineers go, oh, yeah, I get it. Larry Tesler. And after that, it just kind of got away from Xerox. Adele Goldberg. We started losing personnel to Apple over the next couple years. John Couch. A lot of the people that were at Xerox PARC ended up joining my team, like Larry Tesler and others. Larry Tesler. And Apple ended up getting all this technology, improving on it. Steve Wozniak. Steve Jobs felt that Xerox had this great technology, but Apple was the one who could make it cheap and affordable, like Woz had done with the Apple II. Dan Kottke. The graphical interface with the mouse and Windows, that was pretty much taken from Xerox PARC. Bill Atkinson. We tried a lot of things. We didn't just take what Xerox had done. In fact, many of the things that we did, they didn't have at all. Trip Hawkins. For example, the Alto did not have icons. Bruce Horn. And so the double click to open, drag and drop, double click to launch an app that had the associated file. So Smalltalk didn't have such things. There were no entities that were files in Smalltalk. Andy Hertzfeld. The question, for the sake of history, is how much did Apple get from Xerox PARC? And so the biggest issue is, did we have multiple windows before the PARC visit? Bill thinks we did. I think maybe we didn't. It's unclear. But definitely the mouse came out of the PARC visit. We did not have a mouse before then.
Epic fail. It's game over for Atari. The video game craze peaked in the early 80s. MTV VJs talked about their love for Atari on the air. Pac-Man Fever, a novelty song, topped the charts. Hollywood was churning out thrillers like Tron and War Games. Tron's plot fictionalized the obsessions of the Valley's programmer class, and one of its main characters, Alan Bradley, was modeled after Alan Kay. In the movie, the Alan Kay character enters cyberspace to stop a computer program gone rogue. In actual fact, Kay was working on making Tron's fictional cyberspace real at Atari. After PARC fell apart in the wake of Steve Jobs' visit, Kay was recruited by the high-flying computer gaming company to be its chief scientist. He was in charge of Atari's lavish new lab, and virtual reality was one of the main avenues of research. Unlike Xerox PARC, however, Atari research never amounted to much. It was devoted to research, not development. R, not D. And just that one letter, that D, made all the difference. Alan Kay. Things were not good at PARC in 1980, and somebody I knew said, well, as long as you're looking around, why don't you go down and talk to Ray Kassar at Atari? Al Alcorn. Ray Kassar was running Atari, and he would have the staff meeting just for the old-timers, me and a few others. We called it the Limp Dick Society because we knew it was just to keep us amused. I left in 1981, so to replace me, they hired the best R&D man in the world, Alan Kay. Alan Kay. That year, Atari's gross just by itself was $3.2 billion, and that was several hundred thousand dollars more than the entire movie industry in Hollywood. So at that time, Atari was bigger than all of Hollywood. They had money coming out of their ears. Chris Kane. It's funny. Now everyone talks about Apple, but people don't remember how big and pervasive Atari was. At one point, Atari was 27 buildings in 6 cities. You could almost trace the outline of Silicon Valley by connecting the dots. We used to call Highway 101 Via Atari, because you'd be driving to meetings up and down 101, and all around you there are cars with Atari parking stickers. It was that first magical wave of Silicon Valley. Michael Nymark. The company was just rocking and rolling. Alan Kay. They used to send the corporate jet up the coast to get shrimp for the executive dining room. And the joke was you could tell how Atari was doing by the size of the shrimp in the executive dining room. Michael Nymark. Jokes about garbage bags full of jumbo shrimp the size of lobsters. Alan Kay. Ray offered me a job, and the bribe was a huge budget. Al Miller. We had heard rumors that they were spending $100 million a year on R&D, which I don't doubt. David Levitt. Alan Kay was one of my big mentors, and suddenly Alan was chief scientist of Atari, this billion-dollar company that came out of nowhere. Howard Rheingold. At Xerox Park, Alan Kay had sort of been the kid to Bob Taylor, and now Atari was sort of the next generation. Alan Kay was the adult supervision there. Alan Kay. My first act as chief scientist was to hire pretty much all of Nicholas Negroponte's graduate students from MIT, because what Atari needed was something more like what Nicholas had been doing, and God, he had a great bunch. Scott Fisher. I was working with Nicholas Negroponte, and Alan showed up at the Architecture Machine Group with a bunch of the Warner execs in tow. Basically, they came to buy the lab. And Nicholas, of course, in his inimitable way, was interested in that amount of money. But I think in the end he said, this is MIT. You cannot buy the lab. So we were disappointed. But then Alan came back a little bit later and made offers to six or seven of us to come out to Sunnyvale and work for Atari. For me, that was a hard choice, because so many fun things were happening with Nicholas. Jaron Lanier. This was all wrapped up in the founding of the MIT Media Lab, which was essentially all the same people, and which was getting going at the same time, although the Media Lab hadn't quite started yet. Michael Nymark. All of a sudden, by the fall of 1982, Alan had a critical mass, this amazing group of people, and I think we had a half dozen key projects at the time. Alan Kay. We did a bunch of things. Virtual reality, communication. I mean, Atari was basically a consumer electronics company. So my thought was that what we wanted to do was develop media. Tom Zimmerman. Atari research was close to paradise for an inventor. I was doing research on music, electronic music. The idea was to do a voice-controlled synthesizer so you could hum into it and it would play any instrument. You could play a violin, trumpet, flute, just by humming. Very ambitious. David Levitt. Media, music, artificial intelligence, all the things that we knew were going to be part of Atari's future. Scott Fisher. Atari research was meant to be a kind of resource for the whole company, all the operating divisions, and all these crazies that Alan hired that would then go get farmed out to work with different groups. Michael Nymark. I hung out with the coin-op guys partly because they were doing optical video disc stuff, because we had done a lot of that at MIT, of course, just trying to get those into the arcade games they were building. So that was fun. Brenda Laurel. It was me and a bunch of MIT kids, and the most fun thing we did was we started writing memos in the voice of a guy named Dr. Arthur Fischel, also known as Artie Fischel. Artificial. Dr. Arthur Fischel is artificial. Get it? Brenda Laurel. We actually made this guy up. We were a collective of people personifying this guy, who we claimed was the new director of the lab, because Alan wasn't around a lot. Michael Nymark. Alan, as chief scientist, was the head not only of Atari Sunnyvale Research Lab, but Atari Cambridge Lab, which was next door to MIT and Tech Square. And the folks at the Cambridge lab were mostly young artificial intelligence PhDs. And Jaron Lanier, the VR guy with the dreadlocks. Jaron Lanier. Kay was spending most of his time at the lab in Cambridge. Scott Fisher. I think this idea of having this additional member of Atari research that was completely made up was mostly Brenda's idea, but it caught fire quite quickly. Michael Nymark. Artificial was something that we tried our best to have as our little secret from the rest of Atari. We wanted to see how far we could push things. Brenda Laurel. We got him an employee number. An office. Scott Fisher. He could get snail mail there, and we got to a point where Arthur had an email account. Michael Nymark. And a subset of Atari Research, not everybody, had his email password to log in as him. Christina Woolsey. Realized that email was somewhat new at the time, and we used it in the lab very fancifully. Brenda Laurel. I mean, memos were going around on email, and people were sending memos back to him, and I think he had a part-time secretary. Scott Fisher. To get him to participate remotely in lab meetings, we had a pitch-shifting speech device so that we could take turns and always have kind of the same voice. Brenda Laurel. I did his voice on the phone with an eventide harmonizer to lower it in real time. He had a British accent. Michael Nymark. So he developed a personality as being this older, worldly guy. Brenda Laurel. He had a whole family, a whole backstory. He had worked for the British Postal Service. He invented squid jerky, things like that. Scott Fisher. Just seeing how far we could go in getting him into the physical world was a great challenge. Michael Nymark. Eric Hultin had submitted a purchase request under Artificial's name for a Saturn V booster rocket. Brenda Laurel. Alan added a pack of gum and signed it. So this is going through the system, and I swear to God these facilities guys show up and say, well, how are you going to launch this thing? How much space do you need? Scott Fisher. I was a little bit surprised that that actually went through. Brenda Laurel. It culminated in a live video conference with Arthur. We had laid cable all the way across the building down to the conference room so that it really could be live. And I played Arthur in drag with crepe hair. And I wore Michael Nymark's jacket and stuff. And I'm at the desk, and at every cutaway, they put a different city in the window behind me. At one point, some guy in Arab dress comes in and tries to give me an exploding pizza. Scott Fisher. People had no clue that this was totally an act. Brenda Laurel. And then we opened it up to Q&A, and I'm answering the questions, and Douglas Adams was visiting that day, so he was in the audience. Christina Woolsey. Alan did a good job with bringing people through the lab. He would meet somebody and just bring them through. Brenda Laurel. About 4 hours later, I was at lunch with Ray and Alan and Douglas Adams, and Douglas was sitting next to me. They were debating whether or not it was live, because they couldn't quite grok that it could be. And Douglas looks at me and he said, it was you, wasn't it? And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And he pulls this piece of crepe hair off of me, a sideburn that I had missed. And he was the only person who got it. That was stellar. That was just the most fucking fun. Scott Fisher. Artificial kind of makes it sound like we didn't have enough to do, but in fact, I think it was probably one of the most interesting research projects we did there. We were thinking about how do we as a group author and give voice to a character? Brenda Laurel. In those days, people were struggling with building artificial intelligence so they could build good non-player characters. But we thought you didn't need to build a bunch of artificial characters to have a good interactive system. You could have people playing with people, as opposed to people playing with made-up programmed characters. So by making this guy up and having multiple interactions with people at all levels, that was sort of a proof of concept. It presages so much when you think about the value of the things we learned by doing that. Alan Kay. Atari wasn't that interesting. Atari was us learning about corporations. Scott Fisher. Arthur was us projecting the lab director we really wanted. Michael Nymark. On the one hand, if you ask what actually came out of Atari research, the answer, I agree with Alan, is very little. Brenda Laurel. We talked a lot about VR. Christina Woolsey. Virtual reality was not a well-known concept, but we had a big program and played with it for a while. We would spend a lot of time talking about it, writing, but we did not produce anything. We talked a lot. We thought a lot. We wrote a lot. We gave speeches a lot. Michael Nymark. On the other hand, I truly seriously believe that the seeds of both virtual reality and multimedia came out of the work of Atari Research. But Atari itself was going bankrupt, gradually at first and then suddenly. Bob Whitehead. Atari was generating a ton of cash, and unfortunately, when you do that, you tend to just start throwing money at things. There was a sort of disconnect, a misunderstanding of what really drives the creative process. Brenda Laurel. Warner thought that a good license would be a good game. Al Alcorn. Ray Kassar gets this phone call from Stephen Ross after getting off the jet with Steven Spielberg, and Ross basically says, I've bought the name E.T. for you. Ross sent Spielberg a check for, I don't know, how many millions, tens of millions. Howard Warshaw. The licensing deal was for $22 million. If you pencil it out, that's like the most profit you could ever expect to make on a game. Nolan Bushnell. The only way that the E.T. deal made sense is if they sold a certain amount of cartridges. It was all based on the royalty that they would have to pay Mr. Spielberg, and so, rather than being driven by the economics of the market, they were being driven by the economics of the deal. It went from the engineers being superstars to the marketing department. If you have a good product, any idiot can sell it. They didn't realize that. Howard Warshaw. They bought E.T. as a loss leader to keep it away from other people. Back then, Atari was the vast majority of the industry. But there was also Mattel. There was Coleco. David Crane. They had to get it out by a certain time frame for Christmas. Nolan Bushnell. Therefore, the deal constrained the engineering time to 6 weeks. Howard Warshaw. 5 weeks and one day. But I didn't get to start until dinner time the first day. Al Alcorn. Ray was like, what? Ray had learned enough by this time to know that this was kind of crazy. But the deal was done, and he had to do it. Howard Warshaw. Nobody had ever done a game in less than 6 months on the VCS, and I had to do a game in 5 weeks. I was used to working under pressure, but this was just crazy. The CEO of Atari was betting a lot of his career on making this thing happen. Al Alcorn. Throw in the fact that Ray didn't actually ever play games, so he had no way to know the game was a stinker. Chris Kane. It was ugly. It really was unplayable. People talk about it as being the world's worst software game of all time. Nolan Bushnell. People used to smuggle cartridges out to me, prototypes that they would just burn onto ROM, and I can remember getting the E.T. cartridge and thinking that it was broken. Literally. David Crane. And what happened was that most people turned the game on, picked up the joystick, moved it to the right, and E.T. fell in a hole and I couldn't get out. Jim Heller. The 1982 Christmas season was nowhere near as good as what had been projected, because E.T. was pretty much a failure as a game. I guess it still sold probably 2 million cartridges, but that left close to 3 million cartridges that were unsold. Ray Kassar. We made almost 5 million. Most of them were returned. David Crane. And so they've got millions sitting in the warehouses. Well, where do they go? Into the landfill. Jim Heller. We only had 3 days' worth of dumping at the landfill before the weekend. When I came back, I was told that the news media is going crazy as soon as I walked in the building. They're calling, wanting to know what we're doing. Kids had come and scavenged the cartridges that we had dumped at the landfill, and they'd been arrested trying to sell the cartridges. No, this is not good, so I ordered 6 dump truck loads of concrete to be delivered to the landfill. And everybody thought it was crazy, but I figure if I covered them up with concrete, it would keep the kids out of the landfill. David Crane. Same thing happened with Pac-Man. They tried to design Pac-Man, which was a well-known game and it had to work in a certain way. The VCS couldn't do that. So they made a subpar version of Pac-Man, and because they paid so much for the license, They built millions of them, and they sold none of them. Al Alcorn. When they were hurting after the E.T. disaster, they went to Alan Kay. Where is the new thing to put in production? He said, you don't understand. Research, not development. And Ray is like, well, what's the difference? They didn't get it. Alan Kay. Ray came to me and said, Alan, I'm drowning. Throw me a rope. And I said, I can't, Ray. You didn't pay for the rope factory. Al Miller. Ultimately, the only thing that came out was a very lame next-generation game machine based on the Atari 400 home computer. Alan Kay. Atari had had their own version of a 6502 PC, which was, in many ways, better than the Apple II. Al Miller. They had taken the same chips, added some terrible controllers, which were just non-functional, and tried to sell that. Chris Kane. The international sales team were notorious for having wine and cocaine parties. We used to joke that we had the only international sales team in the industry that imported more than it exported. Michael Nymark. In 82 and 83, Coke was everywhere. Chris Kane. The home system was just bombing. But that's okay because we have this huge library of arcade games, this evergreen set of titles, and we'll just keep figuring out new ways to do them and bring them over to the home computer system. We will be fine. Scott Fisher. By 83, it was kind of not so much partying as it was using the drugs to get these 19-year-olds to, like, hurry up and get this damn stuff ported over from the arcade game to the home machine by, like, tomorrow. Here's more. You need more coke? Here, anything. I'll give you anything if you get this done. Brenda Laurel. A guy from BizDev invited me into his hard-walled office, and he had the glass from the Battleship arcade game on his desk. And he caught a big line of cocaine, and he said, here, snort this, it will help you work better. I'd never seen cocaine. I didn't know what it was. I'm a naive hippie, and I'm thinking, cocaine? You know they lied to us about grass, so this is probably fine. And coke became a problem for me for about a year until I realized I was going to kill myself. So there was a lot of coke going around. Scott Fisher. We were all watching this thing go down the tubes because of that. I think that's ultimately why things got so bad. Chris Kane. In 83, the wheels are starting to come off of Atari in a dramatic fashion. Alan Kay. I used to show them slides about what they were spending on and ask, how fast will it go when the thing flips? Christina Woolsey. I was amazed at the exorbitant spending, and it did not taper off. It was exorbitant, and then it was, oh, we are in trouble. Brenda Laurel. And this was right about the time they were burying the E.T. cartridges in the desert. Christina Woolsey. A group of us managers got pulled into a conference room. It was just plush, Hollywood plush. And a man in a suit, I think it was the CEO, said, guys, it's over. We are looking for a buyer. Basically, he laid it all out. He had this wonderful line that caught my attention. You cannot fool 13-year-olds. Howard Warshaw. At the beginning of 83 or so, we're still at about 10,000 employees. By late 83, we were down to 2,000 employees. Chris Kane. You'd call someone in the morning, then you'd call them in the afternoon, and the extension would be disconnected. The company was just being decimated on a weekly basis. Scott Fisher. I remember sitting with Alan Kay in a park in Sunnyvale as a kind of retreat, just getting out of the office and going out to talk about what our plan was for the next 20 years, and then literally going back to the office and finding out that we, well, at least Brenda and me, had been fired and had 15 minutes to get out of our offices. It just seemed so crazy to be talking about 20-year-long projects and then have the security guards escort you out. Brenda Laurel. It was insane, like 5,000 people in one go. I got it that day. Chris Kane. Layoffs of 1,500 people. Now we're used to it, but when it happened in 83, there was no context for it. It was a psychic shock. Alan Kay. Once a month or so, Steve Jobs would come over and have lunch with me, and it used to drive Ray crazy. He'd come along, and here I am sitting with Steve Jobs of Apple. In the course of our lunches, Steve said, "You know, you should come over to Apple." Michael Nymark. It was either in late 83 or early 84 that Alan Kay leaves Atari, and we are all thinking, okay, you know, it's a little crazy out there. But the rest of Atari is still making lots of money, so what's the problem? Brenda Laurel. So the lab limped along for another half a year or so, and then they finally shut everything down. Michael Nymark. But after Alan left, things started tanking very quickly. Atari went from, like, earning billions to losing billions, and I think the first quarter of 84 was the turning point. David Crane. It was a whole disaster. There was a time when Atari lost $100 million in a quarter. Alan Kay. It went awfully fast. In their first bad year, I think they lost $1 billion. Howard Warshaw. By mid-1984, we were down to 200 people. So in about a year and a half, the company goes from 10,000 employees to 200 employees. And I was still one of those people. It was a dark time. Christina Woolsey. We thought the video game business was over. Brenda Laurel. At the very end, I'm told, it was like the fall of Saigon. People were dropping equipment into the trunks of their cars from the second story. You know, it was just like chaos. Everybody moving out and people carting computers down the stairs. Chris Kane. That's when that first magical wave of Silicon Valley ended. There was a shift. The idea that the company was a family disappeared with Atari. Christina Woolsey. If you are young and you don't know how the system really works and you believe in something, then it truly was horrible. It was heart-wrenching. It was socially destructive. Chris Kane. There was a certain feeling of collective mission that broke, and all the corporate folks and off-sites in the world weren't going to put it back together. That sounds overwrought, but if you were there, it wasn't. Christina Woolsey. But this is how the Valley works. People come and go from job to job because startups are starting. Big companies can disappear, too. Jameis McNiven. Titans rise, titans fall. That's the nature of the world. It just happens faster in Silicon Valley. Hello, I'm Macintosh. It sure is great to get out of that bag. While Atari was having its troubles, so was Apple. By the early 80s, the Apple II was starting to show its age. Other competitors, including Atari, but most importantly IBM, were coming out with newer, sleeker machines. Apple was trying to counter, first with the Apple III and then with the Lisa, but both machines were flops. The next machine in line to be released was the Macintosh, and it would make or break the company. The Mac was Jobs' exclusive turf. Although Jobs was the public face of Apple, he did not have actual control of the company. Jobs contented himself with being the non-executive chairman of Apple's board and directing what was, in 1980, a minor research effort, an experiment in making a computer for the common man. He and his hand-picked team of 20-somethings had been hacking away at the idea ever since returning from Park. It took 4 years, but by 1984, Jobs' vision became reality. The Mac put the mouse and the Park-inspired GUI that accompanied it into the hands of the masses. Dan Kotke. The IPO was November of 80, and Steve is raring to go because he had money to spend, right? The Apple III was launching, but Steve Jobs had already moved on. The Apple III didn't interest him because there were too many other people involved, and he wanted to be in charge. John Couch. Steve says, "I want to run Lisa," because it was the newest, newest product. Randy Wigginton. But they weren't listening to him. Steve Jobs. I thought Lisa was in serious trouble. I thought Lisa was going off in this very bad direction. David Kelly. Lisa, the Apple IV, was really mixed up.
Dan Cockey.
Steve was trying to bully the Lisa Group. Randy Wigginton. Jobs was angry at the Lisa Group because they named it Lisa after his daughter, to make fun of him. Steve lived with a girl for several years, Chris Ann, and she got pregnant and insisted that the baby was his. He always claimed that she was sleeping with other people and it was probably someone else's, and no one inside of Apple believed him. And when the baby came, she was named Lisa. Steve absolutely insisted that it was not his baby, and so that is why the Lisa was called Lisa. It was a big fuck you from the engineers and the people over there. So he hung around with all the Lisa folks, basically, until they drove him off.
John Couch.
And so when they wouldn't let him run the Lisa project, he went around looking for something else to do.
Michael Dewey.
And across the street was where the Mac Group was, and the group had nobody in it except Jeff Raskin.
Dan Cockey.
Jeff's outlook on the world was tiny, friendly machines like a home appliance. Jeff was completely obsessed with that.
Steve Wozniak.
Jeff is the one who brought that idea to us.
Andy Hertzfeld.
The Mac was initially a skunk works. At the time, it was not an important project at Apple. It was a very minor thing.
Randy Wigginton.
And Steve went over to Macintosh where Jeff Raskin was, and he and Jeff did not mix well.
Steve Jobs.
Jeff's a shithead who sucks.
Jeff Raskin.
Steve would have made an excellent king of France.
Michael Dewey.
They lasted about a week together because Jeff realized that Steve was going to immediately take over the group, and so Jeff came back to the executives and said, "He's taking over my group. He's wrecking everything." And then they said, "Tough. Steve wins."
John Couch.
I don't think he asked Jeff's permission. Steve just took it over.
Randy Wigginton.
Steve hijacked it.
Andy Hertzfeld.
When the Mac started, the big projects in Apple's future were the Lisa on the one hand and the Apple III on the other hand. Even the Apple II was diminished in their minds, not thinking it would last as long as it did.
Randy Wigginton.
Remember, Steve always had this insecurity about the Apple II because he didn't actually make the Apple II, right? And Steve's idea for the Mac was basically the next generation Apple II for the rest of the world.
Andy Hertzfeld.
The Mac was going for well more than a year before it found what it really was, the Volks Lisa. We were taking the Lisa technology but making it for everybody.
Mike Murray.
But there wasn't a lot out there that suggested the Macintosh would succeed. Could we do it with a smaller box?
Dan Cockey.
The first prototype of a Macintosh was just a 6809 processor, some RAM, and like a video generator. That's all it was. It didn't even have a mouse, and it wasn't good for anything other than just the most simple kind of a demo.
Steve Jobs.
So we adapted the 68000 processor that Lisa had.
Trip Hawkins.
It was just a rocket ship of a processor. Elegant, sleek, fast, a simplified instruction set.
Andy Hertzfeld.
But there was a technical problem. We could not use the 68000 because the 68000 wasn't able to work with 8 RAM chips. It needed 16. And Burrell Smith, being the genius that he was, he came up with an incredible way to hook up the 68000 to 8 RAM chips, what he called the bus transformer circuit. It was this sort of miracle. No one thought it was possible to hook up the 68000 to an 8-bit bus without losing any performance, to go just as fast. And suddenly, when he had that, you had the Macintosh, which cost about 1/5 of what the Lisa was projected to cost, and ran twice as fast. So that is lightning in a bottle. That's an amazing thing. Burrell, in an act of unprecedented genius, was able to do that. And when Steve saw that, he thought, boy, this is the future.
Dan Cockey.
It was kind of like putting a big V8 in a tiny little sports car. It was way overpowered for this tiny little machine.
Joanna Hoffman.
I knew the hardware was amazing, but when Andy joined, the soul of the machine started to take shape.
Andy Hertzfeld. I noticed Steve Jobs peering over the wall of my cubicle saying, "I've got great news for you. You're on the Mac team now." And I said, "Great. Tremendous." This was late on a Thursday afternoon. I said, "How about I start Monday morning? Let me just get my DOS 4.0 notes together." I had worked on a new operating system for the Apple II for 3 weeks, so why not get it so someone else could pick it up? Dan Kotke. Andy and I joined Mac in January of 81. Andy Hertzfeld. Steve got mad. He goes, "The Apple II is going to be dead. Your OS is going to be obsolete before it's finished." And then he said something like, "The Macintosh is the future of Apple, and you are going to start now." I just wanted one day, really. It was Thursday afternoon. I said Monday because Monday seems to be a good time to make a new start. But he goes, "No, you're going to start on it now." And he went and he pulled the plug on my Apple II, which had my code not saved. I was right in the middle of working on it. He just yanks the plug out, and then without pausing, he picks up the Apple II and starts walking away. Steve Jobs. "We were on a mission from God to save Apple." Andy Hertzfeld. "I had no choice. I had to follow my computer. I couldn't work without it. That's why he took it, because he knew I needed it to do any work. So he just took it, then he walked away. He goes outside. His car is always parked in the handicapped space so that it's close to the door. And he plops it into his trunk and goes, 'We're going to the Mac building.'" Bill Atkinson. "We had a place that was behind the Good Earth restaurant, and so they called it Salt of the Earth." Dan Kotke. "Burrell Smith had put a sign on the door that said, 'Danger, Contagious Algorithm Research Area.'" That was Burrell's sense of humor. Andy Hertzfeld. "The Mac office looked like it should be a dentist office or something. Wood-paneled, but cheap. And he drops my computer on a desk and he says, 'This is your new desk. Welcome to the Mac team.' And then he walks out. I open the drawers at my new desk, the desk he put me at, because I don't even have my stuff. I just have my Apple II. And the drawers were all full. It was someone else's occupied desk. And I'm thinking, what's going on?" Randy Wigginton. "Jeff got shipped off to Siberia. You know, Huli? The roof? Jeff was on the roof with the barbecue." Andy Hertzfeld. "I find out that it was Jeff Raskin's desk, who was just exiled the previous day. He hadn't had time to get his stuff. That was my first day." At that point, Lisa was still 2 or 3 years away from shipping. The Macintosh Group was a classic skunkworks operation, a breakaway engineering team tasked with the research and development of an alternate future. It's the engineering equivalent of a special forces unit being sent on a long-range reconnaissance mission. Randy Wigginton. "We had just gone through the horrible, abysmal Apple III, and Lisa just appeared to be going nowhere, so that's why we sort of went off the grid. We were our own ragtag group of people, and, you know, we just wanted to go off and do our own thing." Dan Kotke. "There was this whole thing that Apple was becoming bureaucratic, and so we were the renegade pirates." Bruce Horn. "Steve said, 'We'd rather be pirates than join the Navy, right? We'd rather steal great things than be bureaucratic and lockstep and follow the rules.'" Randy Wigginton. "We were not in the Navy. We hated the Navy. We hated the official establishment." Dan Kotke. "They made a pirate flag, and they put it on top of the building." Andy Hertzfeld. "I was a lookout for installing the pirate flag. On a Friday evening, we cased it. We climbed up onto the roof and looked around, and on Sunday evening, we put it there. But the most fun part was just seeing how people would react the next day. Steve loved it. But some other parts of Apple thought it was extremely arrogant." Randy Wigginton. "We were trying to be very counterculture, even within Apple." Bruce Horn. "We were the rebel group, a little bit more willing to try crazy things." Steve Jobs. "Why can't we inject topography into computers? Why can't we have computers talking to us in the English language? Looking back, this seems trivial, but at the time it was cataclysmic in its consequences.
The battles that were fought to push this point of view out the door were very large. Bill Atkinson. I remember an interesting incident on the icons for the Lisa. We needed a way to show whether there was something in the trash. If you say, empty the trash, is there something to empty? The very first version of the trash can that I wrote had little flies buzzing around it, but they got sanitized out. The Lisa user interface was a little bit hampered by who we thought it was for. We thought we were building it for an office worker, and we wanted to be cautious not to offend. Randy Wigginton. On the Mac, we had the Cookie Monster in the trash can. When you dropped a file onto the trash can, all of a sudden the Cookie Monster would come up and go munch, 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 and then back down. Andy Hertzfeld and Susan Kerr just did that as a demo. Everybody who saw it thought it was great. Dan Kotke. The Mac was a very radical thing because this was the age of CRT screens and big boxes, right? The Mac was going to be a computer you would take to bed with you, like you would sit on your bed to do your work. Bill Atkinson. When the Mac was designed, we had a pretty clear picture of a 14-year-old boy using this thing, and we knew what they were like, so we were going to have fun with that. Bruce Horn. We were all young. Andy was in his late 20s, I was in my early 20s, Steve was maybe 26 or something. And we were motivated by this passion to make the life of everybody using computers much more fun, much more productive, and to give them a certain amount of creative license. Andy Hertzfeld. That was why we were there. It's what we wanted. And the pressure wasn't external pressure. It was our purpose to make something great. The people working on it believed in it. Bruce Horn. And that's how Steve was motivated. He thought of it as an artistic tool, among other things. Dan Kotke. At the point of time when we were finalizing the custom plastic case, the Mac team was maybe only 50 employees. Randy Wigginton. And everybody signed different places on the case diagram. Andy Hertzfeld. Steve explicitly said, "We are signing the Macintosh because artists sign their work. We are artists." Dan Kotke. Then Jerry Manock, the lead designer, shrunk it down and actually put it into the die for the case of the Mac so that we all had our signatures in the plastic. Randy Wigginton. Steve wanted us to be personally invested. He wanted us to be attached to it, and he felt that by having our signatures inside the case, we would be. It was pretty cool. Andy Hertzfeld. But it wasn't until the fall of 1982 that the rest of Apple cared about the Mac at all. So the Mac, Apple began to take it seriously in 1982, once we had prototypes built. But then by the spring of 83, it became clear to everyone that the Mac was the future. Mike Murray. Because the Lisa, which came out in January of 1983, was pretty much a failure. Butler Lampson. It was a bust. It was too high-end. Tried to do too much stuff, and it cost too much. Trip Hawkins. Then Lisa basically gave birth to the Mac. Again, this is a somewhat untold story because Steve didn't want this to be known. Steve basically took all the bright ideas from Lisa and all the best people from Lisa. There were a whole bunch of huge pieces of Lisa that pretty much just shifted right over to the Mac. Steve Jobs. Apple II was running out of gas, and we needed to do something with this technology fast, or else Apple might cease to exist as the company it was. Dan Kotke. The Apple II was paying the bills, but by 83 that was kind of the old generation, and now the Mac was coming. Andy Hertzfeld. If the Mac failed, Apple would fail. Bruce Horn. There was a ton of pressure. Andy Hertzfeld. We'd have retreats every 6 months, and Steve would begin the retreat with quotes. And for the January 1983 retreat, one of the quotes was, "Real artists ship," which meant, "Hey, we've spent enough time developing. It was time to ship." Bruce Horn. Steve Capps and I were working on the Finder. When you boot the system, you boot into the Finder, so it's the first thing you see.
Caps and I worked all the time. I was 23 and I had just gotten braces and I'd have my headgear on at night, and Caps and I would sit and work at night. He was the only person who ever saw me with headgear, and we would listen to Violent Femmes and just hack all night. We had sweatshirts that said 90 hours a week and loving it. Burrell Smith. Back then it was the joy of being absorbed, being intoxicated by being able to solve this problem. You would be able to take the entire world with its horrible problems and boil it down to a bunch of microchips. Andy Hertzfeld. During the fall of 1983, the IBM PC came into its own and started selling. The IBM PC was introduced in the summer of 81, so it took 2.5 years. But by the fall of 83, it was clear that it was an existential threat to Apple. That's when IBM came into focus as major competition to Apple. Randy Wigginton. It was 90 hours, and then it turned into 100 hours, and we were getting really, really tired. Bruce Horn. It was very intense because every time we needed to do something, it would take a little bit more memory space, and then we would have to steal a little bit more from maybe the stack or something, and every once in a while it would break something. Charles Simonyi. The first Mac, and it's not very much appreciated, was a little bit overpowered. So the performance was very high, but the memory was really low. It had 128K memory in the first version, but a lot of that was taken up by the bitmap and by the operating system. So the actual space for the application was pretty much minimal. Bruce Horn. Mac Paint would crash because Mac Paint was like that too. We were just trying to squeeze it in as tightly as possible and working up to that deadline date, and just hoping we'd get there. Everybody was exhausted. I gave it one last push. Randy Wigginton. It was truly insane pressure. I basically lived at the office for about 3 weeks before it shipped. I had a sleeping bag there and would go home and shower every so often, but it was terrible. It was not healthy. We were stupid. Drunk, tired, and at 2 o'clock in the morning when we integrated everything to prepare the release, literally nothing worked. I just lost it. I went totally hysterical. I just started laughing and couldn't stop. I had to walk out of the building and literally walk around the block just to get a grip, because it was not looking good. I mean, the 2 o'clock release was just abysmal, and we only had until 6 a.m., At that point, we were like, okay, well, let's not try to do all that. Let's roll back to stuff that works. And so we did. And it was a shockingly good release. God is good to idiots. Andy Hertzfeld. There were actually two run-ups with huge pressure. The software that was in ROM, the system software, had to be finished before the end of September 83. So there was a crescendo there. And then a party at Waz's house the day after the ROM was frozen. And then around the beginning of October came the build-up for finishing the disk-based software. And then the publicity had a similar thing, because the publicity was designed to reach a crescendo on the day of the announcement. As the Macintosh was being finished, the circuit boards printed, the ROMs burned, the software debugged, Jobs' attention turned toward the marketing push that would accompany the computer's launch. Lee Clow. Steve Jobs' simple challenge was, I think Macintosh is the greatest product in the history of the world, and I want an ad that's that good. Mike Murray. In 1983, Chiat Day had come up with this Big Brother George Orwell idea, and they were shopping it to their clients. All good advertising agencies have a car company, a soda company, and, you know, a high-tech company. So they went to each one, and then they came to us with some storyboards that showed this rough idea. And I remember Steve just liking it. And I liked it immediately. We said, that is great! Lee Clow. Getting the spot approved wasn't that hard. I guess the biggest hurdle was that it required a pretty big budget. They had never spent $1 million on a commercial before. But Steve loved it, and John Sculley had just joined from Pepsi. Dan Cockey. John Sculley was the celebrity CEO that Jobs had hired. He was like this glitzy marketing guy. Li Klau. John Scully wanted to show off and prove that he was really smart, so he said, well, I love it too, because we used to do spots like that at Pepsi. He really never did, but that's what he always said.